Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Hello, good morning. I hope you're well today. A warm welcome to this week's edition of En Camino. On the programme today, I explore two extremities of music in a single weekend while Janie buys a new car. And we ask, has America become ungovernable? How do you go about painting a picture that is 15 metres high? I spend a night in a place called Drongen. We meet the man who stopped human sacrifices to the god Dasbog, and the merit of the five P's, which, in case you don't know what they stand for proper preparation prevents poor performance. It's all on
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Janie, good morning to you.
Oh, hi, Kitty.
Tell me about your last weekend. You were hypnotised in Fuengirola, were you not?
Oh, gosh, yes, I was. I was very, very out of it, I have to say. It was actually a free weekend workshop run by some people who do a professional course. If I'd done it, I'd have been a full-on therapist at the end of it. But I decided not to for various reasons. Anyhow.
Well, how long does it take to become a full-on therapist? Just a weekend?
No. That was the first of 10 sessions. So, I mean, there were 10 weekends. Obviously, you do study in between and everything like that. And then you get enough information, you've done enough learning by about February, where you can start to practice. And then after that, well, that's on that course. And then by June, providing you've passed, you then go on to be a full-on therapist.
Yeah, my daughter, Pigeon, became a hypnotherapist.
She did.
Yeah, and the course was quite extensive.
Yes, it is.
But she's now practicing. And how did it go?
It was very interesting. I don't know. It's hard for me because I've done a lot of this sort of work already. So
why does that make that hard?
Well, because I just wanted to say, well, I know that.
You knew more than the lecturer.
Oh, this is sounding awful, Kit. Don't ask me any more about it, but I decided not to do it.
Were you hypnotised at any stage?
Oh, yes.
And what happened? What's it like being hypnotised?
You are feeling
sleepy.
Exactly, you do. But, I mean, the actual reading of the hypnotic sort of introduction by the proposed therapist is so long. I could bore myself to tears just listening to it and fall asleep anyway. You know what I mean?
So it was hard to tell whether you were being hypnotised.
Yes, because you go
rigid.
So sleepy.
Okay.
But, it was incredibly relaxing. But there were a few things about it that just did not sing with me at all.
Okay.
So
try that and you're going to leave it alone now.
Yeah. She showed us all how to douse with a pendulum at the end. Hers was about sort of the size of a large rock. Mine was tiny, which I had. And she was showing everybody how to douse. And I thought, oh, well, this is the time to ask whether I should do the course or not. And it swung violently in the no direction. So I said no.
Okay. Fair play. Tell us about Paco's painting.
Oh, well.
First of all, remind us who Paco is.
Paco, right. Well, Paco is my wonderful art teacher. He is called Francisco Alarcón Pérez.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just really exciting, very lively, and a very talented artist. And anyhow, he'd just finished this enormous mural in Fuengirola, where I happened to be. So I went to look at it, and it's incredible. It's 15 metres high, the side of a building of apartments, and 6.5 metres wide, and it's magnificent. It's
It's of a
kind of scene from the beach out to sea. It's got a little bit of, at the end, at the top, there's the Fuengirola Castle. There are fishing boats sort of in the mid background, and then in the foreground there are family scenes and fishermen and fish in a basket and grandmother, grandchild, all this sort of thing. It's just really colourful and very vibrant and a happy scene. And it's kind of from his themes of the sea and the art of fishing, inspired by his childhood.
The old time Costa del Sol, how it used to be, lots of sardines.
Yes.
And Mosto.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it was just, it's just a very happy painting that actually reflects him enormously.
Now, you showed me some of his work here in Estepona, and I'm still amazed and slightly gobsmacked as to how you actually paint a picture that size, that where everything is in proportion.
Well, exactly.
How do you retain that sense of scale?
Well, this is the great thing, because on Wednesday, after he'd finished, we had our art class, and he spent the first hour telling us about this. So, of course, what he does, it's a bit like an architect. He draws a to-scale plan of what he's going to do. And then he blows it up onto this building. So it has a grid on it.
Mm.
The original design has grid on it. And he scales that up. So the whole of the side of the building has to be measured. And then he works according to the sort of squares.
Like panels?
A little bit. Like
panel.
He doesn't do it with panels, but because he's so experienced, he can see the form. He can see where he's got to get his lines right in relation to the grid that's going on. And he worked from the top to the bottom, and he gets up there with this pneumatic lift.
Yeah, and a sort of ascensor.
That's right.
Which we use occasionally for palms, I think.
That's right.
That's a long way up, though, 15 metres.
It's a long way up. And I think I
when
said
you're teetering on a platform.
I said, does it shake? And he said, no, actually, it's really solid.
Oh.
And it's got this long, wide area. And he had to prepare all of the paints before he went. Mix them up, get the colours right. He had to know what he was going to do. And then when he got there, as I said, he worked from top to bottom. And he did this. He had the help of his brother at the beginning, because they had to paint the whole side of the building white and then put this coating on it that would help the paint to attach. And then his brother went off and he painted the rest of it within 5 days.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
And this is just, some of them, he said, you know, some of these artists do them within three.
Well, yes. I mean, not the sort of thing you can do in the rain either, is it? Not that it has rained yet, but
no.
We're talking about rain. So
we had a few drips this morning.
Yeah, I think I saw a sort of dark splat on my terrace. Anyway, rain is apparently forecast. So just on these paintings, Janie, where are they actually?
They are, well, there's some in Estepona, we told you about
that.
But
these new ones.
Quite a lot of towns in Spain are doing this now. And this one is in, the one he did is in the neighbourhood of El Bocatillo by the Fuengirola City Council or Ayuntamiento.
Mm-hmm.
People will see them, people who are in the town. And what about you, Kitley? What did you do on the weekend?
Well, my weekend was remarkable because I was fortunate enough to partake in two very different concerts.
Yeah.
On Saturday night, Biagra, my cabaret rock band, played at the notorious Alioli Beer Festival.
That's down by the railway line, isn't it?
In a place called Jimena del Ibar on the Ronda Algeciras railway line. And it's actually rather a remarkable chiringuito bar that I've referred to before on this programme. It was opened about 15 years ago by a guy called Paul Derwent, who used to have a bar in La Cala de Mijas, got bored with the Costa del Sol, decided to take his family inland, and in pioneering spirit, wound up in the middle of nowhere. Jimena del Ibar really is.
I've been there.
It's in a valley in the high Serenia, with a railway line going through it. He was very clever with the railway line because he realised that people could come to enjoy a beer or five.
Providing that it stops there, presumably.
Well, it does, yes.
Yes. The
train does stop. Yeah, there's a platform. So people get off the train. enjoy the music event and then get back on the train and have to worry about driving.
Of course.
Anyway, this particular beer festival, last Saturday, it started at 1 p.m. We didn't play until 10.
10 at night.
10 at night. People had been drinking pretty much solidly. And I'm talking about drinking. I'm talking about proper European beers here.
Yes.
Not, none of your Cruz Campo, but like heavyweight Belgian 8% proof heavyweight. So the audience were pretty well oiled. But isn't a well oiled crowd what you want?
Providing they don't start sort of bashing into one another, you know, in an unfriendly way.
That is the wonderful thing about this country. There's a saying in Australia, if he's a good bloke when he's drunk, he's a good bloke.
Yes.
And that is so true.
It is so true.
And because if you get punchy when you're drunk, you're probably not a good bloke.
No, exactly.
But, and there was no punchiness. There were 300 people there, very drunk, you know, but not unpleasantly so. The Spanish know how to handle even Belgian beer. No aggro, nothing like that.
Oh,
it was
nice.
It was just a really happy vibe.
So no football hooligan star stuff. I mean, that's amazing.
There were no football hooligans there. No, they would have been a long way off track if they'd been in the Merida Lebar. There was no hint of any football anyway. And then on Sunday evening, just 24 hours later, the Gaussing Choir, of which I'm a member, the Pueblo Choir, in the company of seven other Pueblo choirs, gave a concert to the packed congregation of Iglesia de Santa María de la Encarnación La Mayor in Ronda at the instigation of Paco the Priest.
Okay, now, I thought this choir had actually broken up.
It's made a renaissance. Thanks to our wonderful choir mistress, Susan Elvin, who's come back. She's sort of been reborn as a sort of Boadicea type leader of choristers, and took us into this sort of bear pit. Well, it wasn't really a bear pit at all, but it was slightly competitive because there were eight other choirs there.
Yeah.
And we all sung psalms. Mm. And it was convened by this wonderful guy called Paco the Priest, who used to be the priest in Gaussin. And I remember him from the late 90s, an almost unbelievably benign individual radiating the most lovely smile to both saint and sinner. And since then, you know, 20 odd years later, he's obviously gone a bit grey and got a bit of a midriff, but he still shines as brightly as before.
And he'd organised this,
and he had invited all the choirs from all the parishes that he had served to commemorate 25 years of his ordination. It's 25 years since he's been ordained.
Wow.
In this really magnificent setting, this baroque splendour of Santa Maria la Mayor.
So that's the church, is it?
Yeah, that's the church in Ronda. And the choirs came from as far away as Vélez, Malaga, and a place called Algarrobo, both in Azurquía, the other side of Malaga, and they were all dressed in Sunday best, black and white, the women in lace tops, and our choir, I have to say, cut a slightly less formal image. But we performed our under-rehearsed psalm, which was Dar gracias al Señor, give thanks to God, with gusto, integrity, and a mighty soprano solo from Antonia.
Wow. And how many of you were there in the choir?
We were probably 10. And then at the end, the marvellous Santa Maria Prima Donna choir mistress, who's the sort of major duomo of the whole thing, led all the singers. So there were probably 80 or 90 of us teetering on the steps below the altar with a stirring rendition of a psalm called Cantare. Cantare al Señor mientras viva. I'll sing to God as long as I'm alive. I'll sing to God.
It sounds amazing.
During which the priest sang a solo, Paco. Yeah, he sang the main solo. And upon the completion of this opus, the entire congregation got to their feet and applauded, and we applauded them back. It was a wonderful moment in church.
Why didn't you tell me about it? I'd love to.
I had no idea it was going to be like that.
You get up to some stuff, don't you? You really do.
Well, it was just an interesting weekend. I mean, you got up to being hypnotised. So anyway, Janie, congratulations are in order. You've emerged from your month of woe, during which you suffered all manner of pestilence, including a break-in and a written-off car. But now I can see it's gleaming in the TRE car park, you have a new car.
Kelly,
congratulations.
I almost just cannot believe it. It's just, I mean, my last car had bumps and scrapes and dents all over it. Things didn't work. There was no roof lining, so I was constantly showered with this orange stuff. And
yeah, I remember just, the roof. It had that spray, that yellow spray on it.
That's right.
It?
And I had to open the boot with the wire because nobody could fix the boot. I mean, it was just terrible.
No,
I
it was time.
Such a tramp.
Time to upgrade.
And then it got written off. Hey! And so now I have this car kit sitting outside. It is beautiful.
So there it is. I'm going to describe it for you. It's okay. It's not a bread van, is it?
How rude is that? This is not. No, listen, I'm going to tell them. It's a VW Touran, which is a nice chunky car. It can get me down caminos that are not, you know, that get rutted in the rain that's not come yet. And it's got plenty of space inside. I've already filled it up with stuff. And it goes like a dream.
It's a marginally sensible car, yeah, because you can go with Campo Carriles in it. Does it have a name?
Doris.
Doris, okay. Yeah, I've got a friend who's got a drum kit called Doris. Now, it's been said that buying a second-hand car is a bit like buying a pig in a bag. My mate Mel in Hereford used to say that. So, without in any way being condescending, you are a single woman. You're not a mechanic. What advice would you give to someone buying a second-hand car in your situation?
It's really hard to say because I found it so confusing and actually really rather distressing because I have not bought a car since I was about 20, not on my own. And I really didn't know. And of course now in Spain it's different and you know there are people out there trading cars all over the place, ripping them off, ripping people off, adjusting the mileometer things, you know, false papers, all this sort of stuff. But not just that. How do you know what's the right car for you in terms of its age, you know, its mileage, its condition, etc.? And they're so spread out in this country, you know, you could go all the way to Sevilla thinking you're going to go and see a lovely car and find it's absolutely dreadful. So the advice I would give would be just really take your time. Listen to people, but listen to yourself as well. If it doesn't feel right to you, don't do it. Don't go following these great ads that you see online and head off up to, you know, miles away up to Granada like I was going to do without checking online to see whether that company is actually legit and whether what the reviews are like and stuff.
Right, okay, so what I'm hearing from you is go local.
Go local if you can. Go to a trusted garage, a trusted dealer, someone who you know someone else has bought from, and they have a good reputation, which is what I did in the end.
Mm.
I did have a panic on the morning that I was going to go and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, what about the emissions? You know,
because it's diesel, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Emissions are coming in January. And I thought, well, this is a B category. What's that going to mean? And I suddenly thought, crikey, I've got to phone this person. And I just got out of the shower, wandered out of my house. Luckily, I did have a towel on this time. And there was my neighbour looking at me through the window. She went, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I've locked myself out of my place. I've got to climb over the wall.
Yeah, okay. Terrible. So you just said, well, I'm buying a new car. I'm completely distracted.
But I calmed down after that and I went and bought it.
Janie, darling, I wish you all the best of luck with it. May you have many happy kilometres.
Thank you, I will.
In Doris.
I will. And I deserve it too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I really do.
Don't be in any doubt about that.
No.
And finally, on this first part of En Camino, a little bit of history. Every nation or tribe has its iconic hero, a colossus, a cornerstone, a figure seminal in its history, a conqueror, a unifier, a valiant warrior to whom descendants today turn for inspiration when backs are against the wall. El Cid would certainly make a strong claim to this status here in Spain. Joan of Arc in France, maybe. Robert the Bruce in Scotland. Glendower in Wales. Alfred the Great in England. Reading the story of Ukraine I've discovered a man in this mould, an eclectic individual who left his mark indelibly on its history. His name, like the current president, was Vladimir. And like Zelensky today, the original Vladimir ruled from Kyiv. The difference being that in those days, 1,000 years ago, Ukraine as an entity did not yet exist. Vladimir's kingdom was, however, extensive, stretching from modern-day Poland all the way to the Volga, commanding the loyalties of Cossacks, Tatars, Bulgars and Slavs and anyone else in his sprawling domain. Vladimir came to the throne in Kyiv in the year 980 as an enthusiastic pagan, echoing the staunch beliefs of his subjects, who on special occasions like birthdays would make human sacrifices of their sons and daughters to fearsome idols set up on hills around the city. The earliest Ukrainian history, simply and majestically called the Chronicle of Bygone Years, lists their gods as and their names, it's pure Game of Thrones. There's Khors, there's Dazbog, there's Strybog, there's Simargal, Mokosh, and Peran, the god of thunder, who, though made of wood, had a head of silver and a moustache of gold. Vladimir himself surfed the heathen wave with some abandon. The Chronicle of Bygone Years records that he was overcome with lust for women, having 300 concubines, Vishorod, 300 at Belhorod, and a further 200 at Belestrovo.
He must have been exhausted.
Yeah, I thought so too. But the chronicle goes on to say that he was insatiable in vice. He seduced both married women and young girls, for he was a libertine, like Solomon. And I looked up libertine, or is it pronounced libertine? I think it's pronounced libertine. And all I got was licentious. Does as he pleases.
Well, yes.
But Vladimir, increasingly keen that Kyiv, which incidentally predates any mention of Muscovy, modern-day Moscow, that if Kyiv were to gain influence in Europe and not frighten off foreign guests, it needed to up its image and find an up-to-date religion. Not that Vladimir was going to make his 800 concubines redundant, but that his subjects should become more modern and refrain from sacrificing family members to Dazbog. There were plenty of religions to choose from, after all. The first candidate was Islam. Now, the Muslim attitude to women was not in itself disagreeable to Vlad. Effectively, he already had three harems, but could he hack circumcision and abstinence from pork and wine? Absolutely not. Drinking, he said, is the joy of Kyiv. We cannot exist without that pleasure. So disappointed with the Muslims, he sent missions to the Jews and to German Roman Catholics, both of whom failed their auditions. It was eventually in the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople that captured the Kievan's imagination. Now, when I read this in Anna Reed's excellent Borderland, A Journey Through the History of Ukraine, I was confused because the last time I visited the Hagia Sophia in modern-day Istanbul, it was most definitely a magnificent Muslim mosque.
Is that the blue one?
No, it's actually just across the road from the blue one.
Okay.
Have you been there?
I have.
Yeah. So the Muslims did what the Christians did here. When they took over Christian territory, they built mosques on top of churches in the same way that the Christians built churches mm-hmm. on top of mosques mm-hmm. here. Anyway, Vladimir's emissaries visited Hagia Sophia in the year 988. And then it was a Greek Orthodox church, a basilica so jaw-dropping that the Kievans wrote, "The Greeks led us to edifices where they worship their God, and we know not whether we were in heaven or on earth. For on earth there is no such splendor or beauty, and we are at a loss to describe it. We know only that there God dwells among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations." So emblematic to Kyiv's conversion to Greek Orthodoxy is this great, it's great church today,
right.
It's called St. Sophia Cathedral, built by Vladimir's son Yaroslav, completed in 1037, which, wow, you're ever in Kyiv, is apparently well worth a visit.
Wow. And you started out by, he stopped human sacrificing. He started out doing that
he
and then
did.
Stopped.
I just quickly quote you Anna Reid from her wonderful book called Borderland, which is a history of Ukraine. In 988, Vladimir ordered that the old thunder god Perun be dragged down to the river and beaten with sticks. And then he herded the Kievans into a tributary of the Dnieper, which is the river that runs through it, for a mass baptism. Some stood up to their necks, wrote the chroniclers, others to their breasts, and the younger nearer the bank, some of them holding children in their arms. There was joy in heaven and upon earth to behold so many souls saved. It was one of the most important events in the history of Europe, because by choosing Christianity rather than Islam, Vladimir cast Ukraine's ambitions forever in Europe rather than Asia.
Gosh.
So if he chose Islam, the whole thing would have shifted. Goodness me, we're running way behind time, Janie. Let's have a break, and then we're going to go over to the States and hear from Andy Wood. We'll see you after the break.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
It's time to meet friend of and regular contributor to En Camino. With another inimitable letter from New Jersey, let's catch up with what's going on the other side of the pond, live and kicking in the USA. Andy Woods, good morning.
Good morning, Kit. Good morning, everybody. Lovely to talk to you.
And when I spoke to you on Tuesday, I think it was, you were sending me photos of gorgeous little puppy dogs. What was that about?
Yeah, well, I was at a vet conference, veterinary doctors conference. About 1,000 doctors from the East Coast of the United States have their annual meeting, and I was there working a trade stand trying to recruit a couple of vets to help us develop a new product. And then one of the stands there was an animal welfare organization, and they had brought, every day they brought, well, 2 days they brought the cutest little puppies ever. And then the last day they brought kittens, which still caused a lot of interest, but less interest from me. And what they were really highlighting was the crisis that we have in with adoptable pets. It's an interesting story, Kit. During COVID, a lot of people became new pet owners. And also, actually, interestingly, veterinary medicine enjoyed a 20% increase in their business. They were one of the few businesses that really benefited from COVID. People were home with their pets. You look at them, doesn't look well. Let's go to the vet.
Because there were more pets, yeah.
And a lot more people got pets.
Yeah.
They were lonely. And now what's happened is a lot of those people are finding them a financial burden. And so where we in during 2019, 2020, 2021, we would see pictures of empty shelters, they're now full to bursting because people have found them too expensive, or they're just fed up with them, or it was too much of a responsibility, or whatever. And just to give you an idea, in New Jersey, there's just under 17,000 dogs in shelters, 25,000 cats, and about double that in New York State. So a lot of animals needing care. And what they found is there's been a big increase in strays. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is that during COVID, you had to make an appointment to surrender a dog. If you no longer, I can't keep my dog, my landlord won't let me, or I can't afford it, I had to make an appointment. You couldn't just walk in. So,
an appointment where? With a rescue center.
If you had to make an appointment, you can just walk in. So that deterred a lot of people from going. So now they just show up. They can jump the queue by saying, hey, I found this dog walking in the street.
Oh.
So it's really sad. So there's been a big increase in that. So it's just, and last year, 4% more animals went into a shelter than came out, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you multiply that across the country and it's, you know, tens and tens of thousands of animals that are filling up the shelters. So more going in than coming out. So it's really sad. So this little rescue had their stand at the big vet show just to really see if somebody would adopt a puppy, and people were filling out the form. So there was some success, but it really highlighted, it was a small microcosm of a much bigger problem.
Well, what can I say? As a dog lover, it's just a never-ending story, isn't it? And appears to be amplifying. And we have to talk politics. I actually was hoping for a little bit of light relief talking about puppy dogs, but failed to provide any. Let's go from the frying pan into the fire. We've got to talk politics. How can you not, in a brief resume of America, touch on politics? And the perspective from a Europe where democracy is becoming eroded by populist strongmen in Hungary, Poland and Slovakia, and by hamstrung decision here in Spain, is that democracy too is under threat in the US, which appears to be verging on the ungovernable.
Yeah, it's been a very depressing last couple of weeks with the leverage of a small group of very far right wing Republicans. There's about 20 of them in total, and they're in the House of Representatives. House of Representatives is 435 members, 221 of which are Republicans. So they're a very narrow majority, but they, and that's the lower house, and they put the legislative bills together. There's a group there that really only allowed Kevin McCarthy to be Speaker of the House, and the Speaker is the one who determines the legislative agenda. Sorry if this people are glazing over here with civics 101. It's in the weeds and it's pretty depressing, but it is front and center in the news right now. So without a Speaker of the House, bills cannot be brought to the floor. McCarthy made a deal with these devils. These were led by Matt Gaetz.
Right. So the devils are the hardline Republicans who are basically asphyxiating the money supply. Just let's backpedal a moment, Anne, because British listeners might be confused by the idea that we've got Joe Biden is a Democrat, but the Republicans can hold a majority in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, it is a strange system. It's not a parliamentary system. So you've got the lower house, then you've got the upper house, which is 100 senators. So every state has two senators. So if you're Delaware with less than 1 million people, you have two senators. If you're California with nearly 40 million people, you have two senators. The House of Representatives is split based on proportion of population. Mm-hmm. So, and in the White House, you have a Democrat. So the Democrats run the Senate by a majority of one vote, and they have the House. So in order to govern, you need cross-party, you need bipartisanship, you need them negotiating and getting deals done. But this hardline group held, it took Kevin McCarthy 15 rounds of voting to get the speakership, because they kept voting against him. So he kept giving them more and more and more. So he said, we will lower the budget. We will stop the border and everything. And then he managed to keep the government funded, and they voted him out, just threw him out.
So how many are there of them? You're talking about this group holding, having leverage.
Yeah, so
and do they operate as a team, or are they all just mavericks?
Yeah, you've got 221 Republicans in the House, and there's probably about 20 in what they call a Freedom Caucus, and about 8 of those are really complete. I mean, from trying not to be too partisan, you could say we're complete nut jobs.
Who's the nuttiest?
Well, it's hard to say who's the nuttiest. They're led by Matt Gaetz, who is a Floridian. His father was a famous politician. He's on all sorts of ethics charges. He was up on sexual trafficking and procuring minors. The DOJ dropped, the Department of Justice dropped the charges, but he's still under ethics investigation. And he was described recently, actually just this week, as somebody who loved being on television more than he loved the American people. And he's a bomb thrower, you know. Yeah, right. He's a bomb thrower. He sits in the tent throwing hand grenades. And he just says things that the hardcore base, what they call the base of the Republican Party, the people who really rallied behind President Trump, he just says things that are red meat to them. You know, we're going to get rid of all the immigrants. We're going to cut the, you know, we're going to arrest Joe Biden. We're going to get rid of all the taxes. And in fact, just this morning, funny enough, I was just looking before we spoke, President Trump just praised him as a celebrity and a great Floridian.
Right.
So it's almost like a pantomime there.
But the weaponry isn't entirely metaphoric, is it? Because is there someone called Lauren Boebert who actually who owns a gun-themed restaurant in Colorado and actually brought weapons into the house because it's her right to bear arms or something?
Lauren Boebert is interesting. She was just in a lot of trouble. She just got thrown out of a theater for vaping. She was vaping during a live production of Beetlejuice and groping the guy with her. And she denied it all. And then they had a video of her doing it. And she said, oh, I just let my standards slip. I'm going through a terrible divorce. So it was deny, deny, deny. And then, oh, you know, go for the sympathy vote. So she's crazy as a nutcase. And then Marjorie Taylor Greene is the other one, another name that you'll heard. And if you look at the left, the left, there's a group of four Democrats called the Squad, collectively known as the Squad. And when Marjorie Taylor Greene, she got a photograph of her all in camo, fatigues, heavily armed with a gun sight going, the Squad's worst enemy, like as if she was going to storm into the house and shoot them all.
Right.
So these people are, it's politics as pantomime, Kit. It's very sad. And it means we're not addressing any of the issues that are impacting.
Okay, well, let's try and credit them with an iota of intelligence. What is driving these so-called patriots to commit a questionably treasonable act and make their country ungovernable by cutting off the money supply? Well, I mean, what are they reacting to, and?
Well, I think what they saw was that the Trumpian approach of just being acerbic, of being bombastic, worked to get you on TV, to get you a lot of attention, get you a lot of money, donors, you know, flocking to these people from the right. And I think if you really got down to it, maybe they have some deep sort of Ronald Reagan-esque view of economics, of a much smaller government, of, you know, getting the FDA out of vaccines, getting the government out of regulation. And they might have some almost libertarian kind of view that the government should be greatly reduced, taxes should be eliminated. But I honestly don't, when I hear them speak, I just see that they just seem to revel in the attention. They seem to be attention seekers.
Yeah. You don't feel a sense of integrity coming from them. There's some level of corruption somewhere, even moral corruption.
I mean, it's hard for me to be objective because they drive me nuts.
Okay, fair play, mate. Fair play.
Done.
All right, let's talk about the left, because to understand a polarized society, I mean, is that a fair assessment of the US? Or is it just too bland?
100% polarized right now.
Okay.
It's very, very polarized.
All right. Well, that's okay. So to understand,
strong Republican states talking about seceding. So,
oh,
yeah,
no, me diga. You go away. Really? Who's talking about seceding?
Yeah. Well, there's parts of Oregon. Oregon's a very left wing state, but there's parts of it, the rural area, that want to go and join South Dakota. They want the border moved.
Ah, okay, right, but not seceding from the Union. They want to become Dakotans.
It has come up about Texas succeeding. I mean, I don't think it'll ever happen, but the fact that people even talk about it tells you where we are. And particularly as you know, what makes it so strange is unemployment's at an all-time low. The stock market's not doing badly. I mean, the country's compared to a lot of other economies, country's doing quite well. It's not as if it's an awful place. From an objective political standpoint, so it's odd that there's all this rancor.
But it's not just the right that's stirring it up, is it? I mean, you in talking of a polarity, you have to visit both poles. So let's look at the left. Who are the left, and why are they so? You mentioned these people called the Squad. There's Black Lives Matter, I suppose. There's general levels of wokery that the right perceive as being major irritants. What is the left in the States? Briefly, Anne, because we don't have a whole lot of time.
There was the Move On movement, which was big a few years ago, and it was really encapsulated by Bernie Sanders, who did have a very good run. He's a Republican, a Democratic senator. And he really was the flag bearer for the progressive agenda. But he's 82 now, and really they seemed, on the Democratic side, they seemed to be quite quiet. I mean, today he came out and said, criticized Benjamin Netanyahu. So that's his sort of stock in trade. He's the kind of, if you like, the bomb thrower on the left. But I mean, he's 82. He's been around forever. Not really relevant, So
and
it's hard.
Can I? Sorry to interrupt you, but the question I'm just burning in me, and I want to ask this: what have these going back to the hardline Republican rebels? What have they got against Ukraine?
Oh yeah, great question. Yeah, that was one of their demands, was that they said that it's too much money going to a foreign war that doesn't impact us, and they want to stop all funding. And that drumbeat is getting louder. We've, I think, donated $75 billion, more than the Russian military budget. And now the drumbeat is growing, not necessarily to stop it. They want to stop it completely. No more money. But there are members of the Republican Party who are now saying we should look at it more closely. We should maybe think about cutting it back. It shouldn't be a blank check. What do we get? What's the ROI? What's the return on this investment? So the drumbeat's loud, but the people who are saying just stop it completely tomorrow are really these sort of 8 to 20 hard right Matt Gaetz, Taylor Greene types.
Because they're pro-Putin or what? Isolationists? Yeah. And is this American isolationism?
Tough on drag queens, easy on Putin. That was one of the lines that they're all about.
I cannot understand
stuff,
that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was all they had, a whole big thing. Keep drag queens out of libraries. They didn't want drag queens telling stories. They're very socially, all this social agenda is very front and center. But I think it's just, this is a foreign war. It's nothing to do with us. Why are we pumping this money? It's not on our borders. They make a very simplistic view of it, which resonates with people.
Yeah,
it's a huge amount of money.
I've been in the States. It's very easy to feel isolationist there. The whole world is encompassed between California and New Jersey. Why go anywhere else? There's a continental spread of differences and races, and it's all there. It's its own macrocosm, really. Globally, it's a microcosm, but. Talking of New Jersey, and just to finish, how's legal marijuana working a year after it was legalized?
Yeah, shifting gears. Yeah, it actually was legalized. It came into law in April of 22. It was legalized a year before, but New Jersey's got a reputation as a terribly corrupt state, so there was a lot of shenanigans politically. But anyway, April 22. So, 18 months we've had it. We now have 16 licensed shops selling cannabis. I haven't seen any uptick of crime or increased car accidents or anything. But there is now, just yesterday, launched a safe use campaign because so many of the products are sold in gummy format that they're trying to make sure that children aren't eating them just by, you know, in error. Mm-hmm. They just look like sweets, right? They look like sweets. So there's a whole new push to keep pregnant women, drivers, children, so that it's looking to be not regulated, but have more emphasis on safe use.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's gone pretty well. I mean, I don't see anything. I don't see anything bad. And it was on the ballot. We vote for all these things, and I voted for it. Where I live is very driven by tourism, and COVID really impacted tax revenue. So I thought, hey, it was a good deal to get some of those lost restaurant and bar taxes back. And also, you know, when you hear about what goes on in Mexico and Nicaragua with the smugglers, I mean, there's blood on every bag of illegal weed, right? Mm-hmm. Good lives devastated south of the border. So mm-hmm. I think it's been a good thing, and it hasn't turned us into a drug fueled hellhole, which was the fear for a lot of people against it.
Yeah, it hasn't become a rendition of Gilbert Sheldon and Fat Freddy's Cat. Mm. Yeah, and
no.
On that note, that's actually all we have time for. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time, Andy.
No worries. Best wishes to everybody. Thanks for giving me this opportunity, Kit. Lovely talking to you.
Bye-bye now. Andy Wood on the line from New Jersey. Do join us after the break.
Oh, it was great to hear from Andy Wood. But how dire was that?
What a shambles.
Oh, dear.
Ungovernable, divided society.
I know.
Cheer us up, Janie. We've got three minutes to put a smile on our face.
Let's do that. Let's not mention the wars. Okay, well, I've just read a great book. Many of you would have read, I'm sure, Driving Over Lemons by Chris Stewart. But how many of you have read his second book, A Parrot in the Pepper Tree? It is a lovely little book, and it's so funny. It really illustrates Alpujarras.
So, Chris Stewart lives in Granada, doesn't he?
He lives in the Alpujarras, in a very remote, inaccessible valley, which is beautiful, and it's had its threats, as I mentioned, I think, last time to you about, you know, a dam being built in the valley and this sort of thing. I know you're suffering at home, Kelly, with all this development going on. But anyhow, this bit, it just really made me chortle, and I thought how often we misinterpret our, when we hear a Spanish word, we think that it means something else because it's similar to our English one, you know.
It's what they call a false friend.
That's right. Anyhow, he made an assumption, as did his wife, about the word what was it, Kit? Estetica. Was that right?
Etica.
That's right.
Etica.
One would think that's a subject studied by children in school. One would think it's something about ethics, no?
Yes, you would.
Something kind of good.
Something humanist.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, obviously, they did think that's what it was as well. Anyway, this is how it goes. His daughter Chloe asks him one day, "Daddy, you promise not to be angry if I ask you something?" "I'll try to promise, though it does depend on what it is you want to ask me," says the father. "Well, I want to stop going to religion classes. I just don't like them anymore. Can I stop, Daddy? Can I?" "There's no reason I should be angry about a thing like that, is there? I tell you what, we'll have a talk about it when your mother gets home." Normally, he would have to stave that sort of thing off and, you know, really not deal with it.
So what was she doing? She was going to do etica instead of religious studies.
That's right. She wanted to do etica instead. And he's a bit of an agnostic, you know, and they'd looked at all of the sort of religious education and the books and stuff, and for the school. And they thought, oh, well, it probably would be a good grounding for her to have this.
And so she did, as she did Etika?
She did Etika in the end, but at the very final end, they discovered it was actually colouring in.
Colouring in. I wonder if that beats religious studies. Yeah, I can remember something like that at our school. Yes. And that's it for another edition of En Camino. This show is repeated at 7 p.m. on Mondays, by the way. And my thanks to producer Eamon, to my resident guest Janie Jewson, and to you for your company. Have a great weekend. Until next week, enjoy this October, this most mellow of autumn months. There is the Blackbird.
Bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.